This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. The horrific mass killings in El Paso and Dayton have understandably inspired terror in America and calls for expanded gun control, predictive policing, and mental health interventions designed to reduce violence. But Northeastern University criminologist James Allen Fox, the leading researcher on the topic for the past 35 years, tells Reason there is no evidence that we're in the midst of an epidemic of mass shootings. The number of incidents and casualties are simply too small to make such claims, and he stresses the media coverage of shootings ends up creating a false sense that gun violence, which is at or near historic lows, is ubiquitous and growing. In a wide-ranging interview, Fox explains the common characteristics of mass killers, why violent crime involving guns has declined over the past several decades, and how cable TV and social media contribute to a false sense of panic. James Allen Fox, thanks for talking to Reason.
My pleasure.
Let's start by defining terms first. What is the difference between a mass shooting and a mass public shooting?
Well, most mass shootings actually occur in private homes. For example, a family annihilation. Then there's also mass shootings that are related to a robbery or a drug deal gone bad or a gang turf wars. A public mass shooting, generally defined, is a mass shooting where there is essentially no real connection between the perpetrator and the victims, typically carried out in a public place as opposed to a private home. And it can be people they know, such as coworkers at a plant, or it could be total strangers.
And when we're talking about mass shootings, what is the number you prefer to use for the number of casualties or the number of killed?
Well, I prefer using four or more people killed, not including the perpetrator. And that traditionally was the definition going back decades, even when I started doing research on this topic in the early 1980s. And it wasn't until 2013, after the Sandy Hook massacre, that this idea came about that, you know, technically someone is shot doesn't mean that they're killed. And so technically a mass shooting doesn't have to involve any deaths at all. And so the term definition used by Gun Violence Archive, for example, is four more people shot. But what's important to point out is although they matter and they're not inconsequential, they're not the same thing as a mass killing. In fact, in half of the cases of mass shootings, four more people shot, in half of those cases, no one's killed. In three-quarters of those cases, either zero or one person's killed. Now, the problem comes when these numbers, for example, we recently heard that there are more shootings, mass shootings this year than days. But these kind of statistics are reported in the aftermath of a mass killing. And most Americans just don't get the difference.
Yeah.
They get confused. They think that every day we're having episodes like El Paso or Dayton, and we're not. So I think it's important to distinguish the two. So in my book, in my research, I've always held to four more people killed. I think it's clear-cut. Death is clear-cut, whereas an injury can be very minor.
Yeah.
Someone can be shot and have very little in terms of an injury. So four more people killed, not including the perpetrator.
And that would...
By the way, some databases include the perpetrator's death in their victim count or the death count.
And
which
is
really
that,
confuses
me. Yeah, and is that, that's partly a problem because if they're going back and using, I mean, they're using different standards at different times so that you really can't compare or create a pure trend line.
Right. And then also, I should point out that in 2013, the Congress passed a bill related to school violence in which they arbitrarily defined a mass shooting as three or more people killed. Mother Jones, which is one organization that has been collecting data on mass killings, mass shootings, switched from four or more killed to three or more killed, but didn't go back and fill in the data for the earlier years. So if you just take the Mother Jones data and put it on a graph, such as NBC News did last week, you see this big jump after 2013 because the numbers after 2013 include incidents where three people are killed and those before do not.
Yeah, let me just quickly ask you to kind of psychologize a bit, because both, you know, Mother Jones does that, and that has, you know, the effect of kind of amping up hysteria or fear of mass shootings. But Donald Trump also does that when he talks about crime. You know, why do people want to live in a world that has more crime in it rather than less crime?
I don't think that they want to. I think that sensational numbers, large numbers, make for big headlines and lots of readers.
Yeah.
So we have heard in the past couple weeks, you know, more than one mass shooting a day in the United States. And we've seen calendars that show you how many occur each day. I mean, I understand that technically it's a mass shooting, but boy, it misleads the public into thinking there's constant danger out there. And also, in terms of the one-a-day mass shootings, most of them are not public.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are family-related incidents, a lot of gang-related incidents, drug-related incidents, not the kind of random shootings with large death tolls that we saw in El Paso and Dayton.
Can you quantify, I mean, what's, broadly speaking, what's the percentage of kind of private or mass shootings versus mass public shootings?
Well, in terms of, I can tell you mass killings, because
okay,
we have
mass
lots
killings,
of
yeah.
clear-cut data on mass killings,
mm-hmm.
That half of mass killings are essentially family-related episodes. A guy kills his wife and all the kids, for mm-hmm. example, or some other relatives. So half are family-related, and then we have another large category that are felony-related, you know, cover-ups of robberies and gang-related and so forth. And only about a quarter, less than a quarter, actually, are the public variety. So up until a couple of years ago, we had generally on average about four or five public mass killings a year. There's been a slight increase in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. where it's actually reached 10 in 2018. But we're still talking about the rarest form of mass killing. Mm-hmm. It's the rarest, but the scariest.
And in your work, you talk about how, at least through 2015, going back to the early 80s when the numbers are kind of first in place, there really isn't a clear trend in the number of incidents. But then you hypothesize over the past couple of years that there has actually been an increase. Is there a way, or is it useful to talk about that in terms of, is the increase statistically significant, or is it that there are just so few instances, even if you're almost doubling the number, it's still, you don't know if it's signal or noise?
We don't really know whether this trend will continue.
Mm-hmm.
It's only been a couple of years we've seen this bump up. And by the way, there have been other times in the past three, four decades where we've had a spike in the number of mass killings, and people start declaring them epidemics, and all of a sudden the epidemic dissipates. So, you know, 2017, 2018 saw an increase in 2019 so far as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this trend will continue. I certainly hope not.
Yeah.
But I will tell you that part of the problem is there really is a contagion effect. And now I'm not talking about publicity about the shooter, you know, and I don't subscribe to the don't name the shooter or show his face.
Okay.
What I basically mean is that there's tremendous amount of panic in this country, obsession with the whole idea of mass shootings, the majority of people thinking that they're going to be, that someone in their family is going to be a victim of mass shootings. And the more we obsess about it, and the more we see on television images of people crying and running from crime scenes, and it plays right into the mindset of a few people out there who would love to see that kind of event in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually are contributing to it through our fear and obsession.
Is it true that while the number of incidents haven't been going, or it's not clear if they've been going up or it's a continuing trend, but are mass shootings or mass killings, are they becoming more violent or more fatal?
Well, we do know that some of the largest that we've had have occurred in the past dozen years.
Mm-hmm.
Over half of the largest have occurred in the last dozen years. You know, if you look at cases in which, for example, more than 20 or more people were killed. You know,
mm-hmm.
we had Pulse in Orlando.
Yeah.
We had Las Vegas shooting. Of course, we had El Paso, and we had Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook. You know, there were also cases prior to, in prior years. We had 21 killed at a McDonald's in 1984. We in 1991 we had 23 people killed at a Luby's cafeteria. But we have seen this increase in the large body count incidents. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also hard to establish a trend based on what five or six people have done in a country of 330 million.
Can you talk about the, is there a general profile of shooters? The El Paso and Dayton shooters seem, you know, on the one hand, the El Paso shooter left a very ideological manifesto where he, you know, explained things. He referenced other, you know, the Christchurch killing in New Zealand and various things. The Dayton killer did not seem to leave any record behind. Neither did the Vegas shooter, which is strange. But is there, you know, are they, what motivates mass killers? And is there a clear understanding, you know, that kind of can explain the whole mess of people, or are they really kind of idiosyncratic?
Well, there are some common factors that are present, not in every case, but most cases. Typically, the mass killer has a history of frustration and failure and disappointment in life, struggling at work, in relationships, at school. And then secondly, and importantly, they blame other people. They externalize blame. Nothing's ever their fault. The wife doesn't understand them. The guy, the boss doesn't give them the good assignments or the recognition they deserve. They see themselves as victims of injustice. If you think you're to blame for your own inadequacies, you might take out your frustrations and misery on yourself, but not on others.
Yeah.
And then third is that these individuals lack support systems. They oftentimes live alone or live with other people with whom they don't share their problems. They don't have others to bounce things off, to help them get through the hard times, and to give them a reality check when they start thinking that they're the ones who's being mistreated and no one else is.
Are they exclusively male?
95% are male.
Yeah. What does,
and then 90% of murderers are male.
Right.
So, you know, murder itself is a male-dominated activity, and mass murder even more so. Well, the other two factors is of course, access to a means of mass murder destruction, which is part of the reason for the dominance of men. Men are much more comfortable around guns, oftentimes are trained in having used guns, or go target practicing. And then finally, there's some precipitant, which is generally something like job loss or being kicked out of the house, which, by the way, is often much more impacting men. A guy who loses a job, not only does he lose his income, he tends to lose his friends because men tend to build their friendships and work, and also his self-esteem. You know, men oftentimes judge their self-worth by what they do. Women typically judge their self-worth by what they are as a person and what they are like as a friend, etc. So there are reasons why men predominate. But regardless of what characters you put piece together, there are countless Americans who are angry, bitter, resentful, feel like they've been the victims of injustice, who wear black clothing, who play violent video games, who write ugly words on the internet, who own some guns. Yet they don't turn their angst into action.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that President Trump just last week articulated wanting to have a tools to detect mass shooters before they strike, can't do it.
Yeah,
it's a rare phenomenon, unfortunately, and rare events are impossible to predict because there are so many false positives, so many people who scare us, people who look like they could be a mass killer, but they're not.
So let's talk a little bit about the policies that people believe might reduce the occurrence of mass shootings or mass killings. You mentioned kind of Trump having a, you know, the kind of precognition of like being able to flag people ahead of time. There's also red flag laws where, you know, that are already in place in a couple of states, and people are talking about broadening that, where family members, law enforcement, other people could say, you know what, this person's been talking kind of crazy. We need to suspend their access to guns or weapons. So you're saying there's really no way to predict without really throwing a blanket on large, large numbers of false positives.
Right. And I don't know where we'd put all these people once we flag them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, keep in mind that we do judge, we do value our personal freedoms in this country.
Right.
And going overboard at trying to do something to people who've never acted on their anger would certainly be that kind of violation. Also point out that most mass shooters don't have criminal records.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't even get them on that card. So let me talk about red flag laws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have been in existence in a couple states for some years. Connecticut passed one after Sandy Hook. Indiana passed one years ago after a shooting of a police officer. Interestingly, all of the evaluations that have been done on these laws were in terms of suicide.
Hmm.
Now, these laws are designed to deal with people who are dangerous to themselves or others, but the evaluations show an impact on suicide.
Hmm.
Homicide is a very different kind of thing to prevent.
Right.
You know, one of my concerns with the, although I'm in favor of generally with the laws, it's the devil's in the details here. One of the problems can be if you have an individual who's angry, bitter, threatening other people, owns a gun, the attempt to take that gun away can actually precipitate the very violent act that you're trying to prevent. So we have to be very careful about doing this kind of removal of guns from people who own them. We don't want to create more violence.
And talking briefly about suicides as a percentage of gun deaths, I mean, there's what, about 32,000 gun deaths a year, and about two-thirds mm-hmm. of those are suicides. Is that accurate?
Right.
Yeah.
That's true. And it's interesting, a lot of the talk about, and particularly in the public health field, about guns and the dangers of guns, lump them together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they are all deaths. But the strategies for dealing with suicide are quite different than the strategies for dealing with homicide.
Mm-hmm. And neither of them is good at really dealing with mass shootings or mass killings.
Right. Well, mass killings are a very, very small tip of the iceberg. You know, we have, in terms of mass killings, a form of people killed, the kind of events that we see reported in the news with large victim counts, they're about two dozen a year. On average, and claiming mm-hmm. up to 200 people a year, 200 victims. Now, that's out of 10,000 gun homicide victims every year. So we're talking about something that's less than 2% of our homicide problem. Now, what's interesting, though, is when you talk, for example, about gun control, most of the suggestions regarding gun control, the right thing to do, this is not necessarily the best reason to do it. Mass killers are extremely determined individuals. They will get a gun no matter what barriers we put in their place. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. In fact, I think the greatest impact of the gun laws we talk about are on the ordinary kind of everyday gun violence that we have in America.
Mm-hmm. So it's, you've talked about this or written about this in the past, that certain gun control measures might affect crime or suicide, but not mass killings.
Right.
Yeah.
But mass killings give us the motivation for doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But don't expect it to impact mass killings. And we probably would never even know because the number of mass killings is so limited
mm-hmm.
that discerning a change is very difficult to do anyway. Same thing holds with mental illness, if I may mm-hmm. go into that area. In the wake of mass killings, we hear talk about increasing access to mental health treatment. It's the right thing to do, but this is not the reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we talk about that on some random Tuesday or Wednesday? Why do we always just talk about it in the wake of a mass killing, which, by the way, tends to conflate mass murder and mental illness as if they're synonymous and increases the stigma associated with being mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after Sandy Hook, for example, Barack Obama went to Hartford to give a speech, and he said that we need to do something about the mentally ill before it's too late. Now, the question is, why? Are we doing it because we care so much about the mentally ill, or is it because we care so much about the people they may shoot?
Hmm.
And I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
I think we should do it because we care about the mentally ill.
Hmm.
And let's understand, too, that a majority of mass killers are not mentally ill.
So when you say they're not mentally ill, what do you mean by that? That they're not like Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook shooter, or are they more
right.
like the El Paso killer who, on some level, you could argue anybody who sprays bullets into a crowd is mentally ill. But what you're saying is they're not presenting kind of classic you know, right. dissociative, paranoid, schizophrenic, rantings or something like that.
Well, they're mad.
Yeah.
But I don't mean mad as in the extent that we often use it as a synonym for mental illness.
Right.
They're mad in terms of anger. Now, these people obviously are not well adjusted. They're not, they oftentimes don't want to live anymore. But they're not out of touch with reality.
Mm-hmm.
They don't hear voices commanding them to kill. They're and they generally are not individuals we would have committed.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, are they completely happy, healthy, normal individuals? No,
mm-hmm.
They're people who are miserable, angry, bitter, want revenge. But that doesn't mean someone is mentally ill.
Right.
Now, the other thing about it is people who are severely mentally ill generally would have a difficult time carrying out a detailed plan involved in mass killing. Most mass killers often plan these events for weeks. All sorts of details, where they're going to do it, what they're going to wear, acquiring their weaponry. There was a guy, for example, in Wisconsin a few years ago, who made videos. He was going to go commit this mass murder. He had all the guy was terribly disturbed. And the day he drove to a McDonald's, and he was so confused that he locked his ammunition and his guns in the car along with the keys. He wasn't clear-headed enough
right.
to carry out this massacre. So it takes some control and some clear-headedness to do this.
So is there a copycat effect at all? You talked a little bit about a contagion effect, the idea that we end up talking about this stuff so much that we end up living in a world that is not real, but it tempers our behavior, our willingness to go outside, et cetera. Is there a copycat effect that that mass shootings or mass killings tend to come in clusters?
There is, yes. Best evidence, actually, in the late 1990s, we had a whole series of school shootings, multiple victim killings in schools. We had four in one school year. We had more casualties in the last 5 years of the 90s than we did in the past 5 years. The 90s are worse. And they generally, the idea, the message was one way to get even with your school, your enemies, the bullies, is to bring a gun to school and shoot them. Now, we had a whole cluster of killings, including Columbine, and then we had one in San Diego in 2001, and Dan Rather declared school shootings a national epidemic. And then in the fall, we had 9/11, attack on America, and people stopped talking about school shootings and started focusing and obsessing on international terrorism and Al-Qaeda. There wasn't another multiple-victim mass shooting in this country for 4 years. See, part of the problem is we obsess over it, and we reinforce the idea that mass shootings, picking up a gun, is a way to get even.
Yeah. Does that explain, I was just thinking about this past weekend, at least four people were murdered in Chicago over the weekend, and something like 40-something people were wounded. That kind of statistic doesn't seem to inspire the same kind of national or, visceral reaction that a mass shooting does. What goes into the way that kind of culturally or socially we digest these different types of violence, even when the levels are kind of same? Or I guess in a typical weekend, certainly, or in a typical week, more people are going to be killed in street homicides than in mass killings, but it doesn't seem to bother us.
Right. Well, 31 people were killed in the weekend of Dayton in El Paso. An average day in America, about 31 people are killed by gunfire. So, yeah, all deaths are important. And whether you're killed along with eight other people or killed by yourself, you're just as dead. Now, obviously, instances in which lots of people are killed is just a bigger news story because it's unusual. And also what determines the level of attention and publicity is the nature of the crime, the motive, and the nature of the victims. Well, for example, the Chicago shootings in the same weekend, a lot of it had to do with gang issues.
Right.
And Americans don't identify with that. They don't feel threatened because they're not in a gang. They don't think it's part of their world. Whereas the situation in El Paso and in Dayton, for example, is they could have been them, could have been a relative, could be anybody at any time, anywhere. So even though those instances are rarest, as I said, they are scariest. Another thing is the nature of the victims. You know, when Sandy Hook happened, people were astonished that there could be an elementary school being the target of an attack. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1989, there was an elementary school that was a target of attack. It was five elementary school kids were killed, and another 30 were wounded. And in Stockton, California, all the victims were all Southeast Asians. Mm-hmm. It didn't quite have the same impact on the American psyche. Mm-hmm.
So this is an extension of when a white woman gets kidnapped or something, there's more news attention paid than when a black woman or a Latino does.
Right. But the other factor, too, since I brought up a case from the past, is the nature of the media coverage of mass killings. Mm-hmm. If you go back a few decades, we didn't have around-the-clock, 24-hour news coverage on cable news channels. In fact, back then, there was only CNN, and they were hardly the presence they are now. And when a mass killing happened, it was the bolt in the bottom of the screen of tune in for more details at 11 o'clock. Also, we didn't have the satellite trucks and the ability to carry these things into people's living rooms in high definition. So when Sandy Hook happened, for example, everyone watched on their television. They saw the children being led out of the school with tears still fresh in their eyes. Makes it feel like it's happening just down the street. Mm-hmm. So the mass killing really, for the most part, mass killing has not increased. Yeah, a little increase the last few years in public cases. But over the years, there really hasn't been this increase. Mm-hmm. But what has increased is the amount of media attention and fear.
Well, speaking of that, in the wake of the Christchurch mass killing in New Zealand, the government criminalized possession of and the sharing, especially, of the shooter's manifesto. And the media in New Zealand actually banded together to say they were going to minimize various ways they were covering the trial or the event and the fallout and whatnot. Apart from First Amendment issues in the United States, you know, is there any reason to believe that sort of action actually would reduce shootings or be beneficial?
Well, I don't think it's so much whether you cover the event as opposed to how you cover the event. You know, there are folks who say we should never mention the name of the killer or mm-hmm. show his face. It's not it's the act, not the actor, that others applaud. Mm-hmm. So in New Zealand, where the prime minister didn't want to mention the name of the perpetrator, doesn't matter what his name was Smith or Jones, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. What other white supremacists applauded was the fact that he killed 51 Muslims in two churches. Mm-hmm. So it's the act that's important. Now,
so does that mean, though, that you would say 51 people were killed, but you wouldn't say they were in mosques or they were Muslim or something like that? Or
No, you need to report the news. Mm-hmm. The facts are important. People deserve to know what's going on. But there's an important line that's crossed between news reporting and celebrity watch. For example, in the Las Vegas shooter case, under this notion that we have to know all the details to predict who the next killer will be, although we really can never do that, mm-hmm. we know about the Las Vegas shooter, what shoe size he wore. We know about his favorite casino games. He liked karaoke. We know what he ate on the evening of the shooting. We have pictures of him on his high school tennis team as if playing tennis is a warning mm-hmm. sign. We know more about him than we know about our next door neighbor. And that's a big problem because we humanize killers mm-hmm. by talking about all the superfluous, unnecessary details about their lives, their mm-hmm. dislikes, their hobbies. The basic facts are important. Who they are, age, race, gender, how many weapons, how they got them, what their motive was. But too often we go overboard.
Yeah.
That's where they can become celebrities in the eyes of like-minded individuals who see them as heroes.
So this is like with the Tsarnaev brothers of the Boston bombing. That seemed to be an exemplary case of that, where you know, the surviving brother actually kind of becomes a pop icon almost, or is on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Right. That was totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
Totally beyond what's required for news reporting.
Right. But going back decades, and certainly, you know, after Columbine, where it's fascinating that all of the early kind of analysis of Columbine, of kids, you know, being bullied and playing certain types of video games, et cetera, that all kind of it turned out not to be true, but it's still how we think about this. But can you talk a little bit about the larger discussion immediately after El Paso and Dayton? We heard, you know, depending on the political bias of a particular speaker, they would say, you know, this proves that violent video games or music or movies, you know, creates killers. Other people were saying that it's, you know, it's the president's rhetoric, that Donald Trump is talking about invasions and, you know, and his helpers in the press are doing. Is there any reason to believe that there's a larger kind of cultural conversation that actually ends up feeding into any of these acts?
I'm not sure exactly. I don't fully understand the question. I'm sorry, but
okay. Well, I guess, you know, are we? Is it a fool's errand because these actions are so you know, so rare ultimately, to try and link it to anything specific that's going on in the culture? So, you know, like a rise of violent video games, or, you know, incendiary political rhetoric and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, if there's evidence that, strong evidence that something is a factor, then we should discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, discussing guns obviously is germane to a discussion. But when there isn't any, it's just assumption or deflection, then I think it does a disservice. And I think that's true with the discussion about video games.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is true that some mass killers have enjoyed video games. Not a majority, some have, but shouldn't surprise us that if someone is a violent individual, that they enjoy violence in their spare time as entertainment. Successful businessmen and women read the Wall Street Journal. I know the Wall Street Journal would like you to believe that they became successful because of their reading of the journal, but no, it's the old chicken and the egg, which comes first. And someone like Adam Lanza, there was lots of discussion after Sandy Hook of his frequent playing of violent video games. And by the way, he also played Dance Revolution.
Right.
It had nothing to do with violence. It was his social awkwardness and isolation that contributed to his spending long hours playing games.
Mm.
It's not that the games made him what he was.
Right.
So there we had the cause and effect completely reversed.
Let's talk a bit more about broad trends in kind of violent crime in American society. In the 90s, you embraced a theory or helped articulate a theory that violent crime committed by young men was going to skyrocket. And you, pointedly, you didn't use the controversial phrase that I guess John DiIulio had coined, a super predator, but you did, by your own admission in a USA Today column from a couple of years ago, you did admit that you predicted a teenage bloodbath. None of that carnage really materialized. And, you know, as
right.
it stands now, violent crime and crime, including homicides committed by guns, is at a fraction of what it was 20, 30 years ago, or even 50 years ago. What is your best explanation for this unbelievable and, you know, unexpected decline in violent crime in American society?
Well, a lot of the decline occurred because there was an increase. Had there not been the big run-up in violent crime, particularly homicide, from the mid-80s to the early 90s, we wouldn't have seen the big decline. What goes up must come down. That's what Sir Isaac Newton said, even though he never studied criminology.
Right.
So part of it was naturally what happens. You know, it can be, one can often get fooled by short-term spikes, which is why I'm hesitant, for example, to say that the increase in public mass killings we've had since 2017 is a harbinger of much worse things to come. It may be, but I'm hesitant to say that. What we saw with with juvenile crime was more than just a 2-3 year factor. It lasted for about 6 years. Now, people said, do I apologize? No, I don't apologize for having used strong language. And my purpose was to get attention to the issue, mm-hmm. because the overall crime statistics in this country overlooked the fact that there was this segment of the population, young black males in particular, but also young white males, mm-hmm. where violence was increasing, and we had to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And people said, "I'm to blame, partially blame for the increase in incarceration." That was never my message. My message was we had to do something. We need to prehabilitate, not rehabilitate. We mm-hmm. need to invest in prevention programs. And I should also say that that was also Joe Biden's message back then. Hmm. Of course, then we had the Republican takeover of Congress, the Contract with America, which took a lot of the funds in the crime bill and diverted them to prison construction. That wasn't Joe Biden's fault.
What was going on then in youth America that was giving rise, that we saw increasing violent crime rates among young people? What is your best take of the conditions that led to that?
Well, the strongest evidence, and of course, there are many factors when you see an increase like that, and many factors mm-hmm. you see a decrease. But the strongest had to do with the emergence of crack cocaine mm-hmm. markets. That crack was sold in very small quantities, and the dealers needed basically a sales force. And teenagers were recruited into the crack selling business mm-hmm. because it was perceived that they would not be punished severely because they were juveniles. They were willing. And as kids were recruited to sell drugs, they had to have guns because it was a very violent, competitive business. Mm-hmm. So it largely had to do with this violence associated with crack markets.
And so then it's once the crack markets are settled, things become more peaceful.
Yeah, and I like it to the, if you recall, when Cabbage Patch Dolls first came out and mm-hmm. they were so popular, you couldn't even get them anymore because there were so few of them, and grandmothers were pushing each other in Toys R Us right. to get the last one on the shelf. Well, eventually there were so many available that there was no more pushing and shoving mm-hmm. to get them. So it's sort of the same thing that when crack markets first emerged, there was a tremendous amount of violence, largely associated with trying to carve out the largest share of the market. Eventually, the market settled, became stabilized in equilibrium, and then the violence went down. Now, also, part of it was that called the younger brother effect, that a lot of the younger teenagers saw what was happening to their older brothers mm-hmm. who were selling crack or even using crack, that they were dying, they were getting shot. And part of it was that the younger kids, to some extent, avoided the mistakes of their older brothers.
Hmm. If we take a longer view, though, is it the case that violent crime or crime in general, I guess, and these are, it's worth keeping them distinct, but did start picking up in, post-war America in the late 50s and the 60s, and it kind of all peaked in the 90s and is now down. And is that, because you can say everything that goes up must come down, but it's, for a 20 or 30 year period, it did seem like crime in general was just increasing and could continue to. So what would explain that larger kind of rise and fall of crime?
Well, actually, it started rising in the early 1960s mm-hmm. and peaked in 1980. Hmm. And then from 1980 to the mid-80s, we saw this big decline in homicide.
Uh-huh.
A lot of things changed in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And part of it was actually the demographics, that we had the surging population of baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do know about crime is that teens and young adults are much right. more apt to commit violent crimes than their older counterparts.
Right.
So a lot of the increase that we saw in the 60s and 70s was demographic in nature. Plus, there are a lot of changes in our society mm-hmm. That contributed as well. But then, so we saw the decline after 1980 until the mid-80s, when we started seeing this new thing, this new phenomenon, which really didn't exist before, which was kids killing with guns. Previously, it was kids killing with knives.
Hmm.
Gangs carried knives, mm-hmm. switchblades, like, the Jets in West Side Story. But starting in the late 80s, this had a lot to do with the crack markets, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. kids started having to have access to guns. There was a juvenile arms race,
yeah,
where some kids had guns for offensive reasons, some for defensive reasons, and some just because it was status.
What so now, though, between millennials and who can be almost 40 at this point, but between millennials and Gen Z, we have a gigantic population of young men and whatnot, but they don't seem to be particularly violent. Is that because the society changes or kind of the social institutions that keep people in check aren't as ragged as they were in the 70s? Or what do you think explains that?
I really can't say. I mean, it's a very difficult question mm-hmm. to answer. I'm not sure I have a good one for it. We can just enjoy the fact that the rates aren't what they were. But I think for the most part, if you look at the rates of violence among adolescents now, it's what it was prior to the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this big rise in violence among adolescents in the 80s and early 90s, and then it evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, throughout that time, violence among adults was declining.
Hmm.
We never saw a big surge in murders committed by people over 25.
Hmm.
We saw a substantial decline, for example, in intimate partner homicide, particularly men not being killed by their partners.
Hmm. How did you, just as a kind of final thought, why did you get into this field? Or like, what is your intellectual genealogy? And, you know, what was the source of your curiosity that you've made this your life's project
sure.
be, you know, really kind of going deep on a very grim topic?
Well, in terms of mass killing,
mm-hmm.
well, I first got in criminology basically because I took a course in grad school that really excited me and a professor that interested me. And I combined it with my background in statistics. But then in the early 90s, and that's where I did a lot of my forecasting work
mm-hmm.
about what would happen in the future. And by the way, I would tell you that the forecasts were accurate for many years, having to do with demographics. But then in the early 1980s, a colleague of mine, Jack Levin, and I started talking and saying, you know, no one's ever done the study of mass killers. We have this idea that they're glassy-eyed lunatics who have this insatiable desire for blood, or they suddenly snap and go berserk. And is that true? So we collected a data set of about 42 mass killers and wrote a paper on it and got some coverage in the Associated Press, which really caught on because mm-hmm. some of the findings were contrary to most conceptions of mass killers.
Mm-hmm.
So then we wrote a book and did a book tour and lots of speaking requests.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've spent almost 40 years studying this topic. I can't say that I grew up fascinated with mass killers. I didn't. I somehow just got into this topic because of a research interest and have stuck with it. It concerns me a little bit, I should say. You know, I've been studying mass shootings and mass killings since the early 1980s. And when very few people, only four people, I would say, were interested in it academically. And it wasn't until after Sandy Hook, after 2012, that all of a sudden this big surge in interest. And now, if you look at the amount of academics interested in the number of scholarly papers being written, we have a whole group of new experts. Some of the expertise is genuine. Other, I'm not so sure.
How do you tell the difference? Or how, you know, I guess as a closing comment, for people who are following this, you know, inevitably we're following it mostly through the media. You know, what are the tells that this is solid analysis, and what are the tells that, you know, this is kind of, you know, balderdash, for lack of a better term?
Well, unfortunately, there aren't very good tells,
mm-hmm.
except I would be wary of people who talk about epidemics.
Mm-hmm.
There is no evidence that we are in the midst of an epidemic of mass shootings. Even those who talk about the one a day, you know, from the Gun Violence Archive, those data only go back to 2013. There has, and no one can say how many we had in 2010 or 2005. So I have to be very careful about hearing a number and thinking it's a trend. The other problem, I should say, is the difficulty that when people try to go back in time and collect data retrospectively. For example, the FBI has done this work on active shooters, oftentimes confused with mass shooters. They're not mass shooters. They just perhaps have an interest, a desire to commit a mass shooting, but most of them are unsuccessful. In fact, a quarter of active shooters don't kill anybody. Another quarter only kill one. Anyway, we often hear that those numbers have tripled in the past two decades. Well, that's because it's very hard to find those cases in the earlier years. According to the FBI data, there was only one active shooter in the year 2000. In this entire country, only one person picked up a gun and had an interest in killing people?
Yeah.
I don't believe it. In fact, they missed a lot of cases, and it's very hard to go back in time and find them. Just as some evidence, as evidence, in the first 4 years of the FBI's active shooter data, which were collected retrospectively, only 9% of active shooters killed no one. In the last 4 years, since they started collecting the data actively, 27% of active shooters killed no one. So either active shooters of today are bad shots, not like their predecessors, or they just couldn't find cases in the early years when someone pulled out a gun, went into a public place, but didn't kill anybody.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you, James Allen Fox, for talking to Reason about mass shootings and mass killings. Where is the best place for people to follow your work?
Well, they could go to my website, jamesallenfox.com, jamesallenfox.com. I write for USA Today as part of their board of contributors. Mm-hmm. All my columns are there.
All right.
And my Twitter handle is at James Allen Fox.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, Reason, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.